Let's start with some biographical information about you. You have so many professional affiliations that I'm going to try and do my best to do them all justice. First, you're a recent Rice alumnus.
That's right.
You received your DMA in composition here this past spring. And I know something really great about the composition program here at Shepherd is that we switch teachers every year. So who have you studied with?
My first year, I studied with Shui Chen, which was a really wonderful experience. And then in my second year, I moved to Karim Alzan, also just fantastic. My third year, I studied with Tony Brandt, and we were doing really good work together, and I decided to continue to work with him actually into my fourth year.
Oh, cool.
And asked him to be my thesis advisor. So I wrote Everest, the piece that's about to be premiered, with under his supervision.
Awesome. You received your master's degree in composition at the Cleveland Institute of Music in 2005, and you graduated with the BA in music from the University of Chicago, UChicago, in 2003. One thing I know about UChicago, other than that it's where the fun goes to die, is that the frat scene is unconventionally nerdy, which I only mentioned because you were president of a chapter of a music fraternity there. Phi
Not
Beta.
There, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, was this at Cleveland?
Yeah.
I'm sorry about
Epsilon
that.
Phi Epsilon is the fraternity, and I was president of the chapter there at Cleveland Institute of Music. Yeah.
Then what's Phi Beta Kappa?
Phi Beta Kappa is it's an honor society for people who graduate from liberal arts schools in like the top 10% of their class. It's an organization that promotes the liberal arts throughout the world and. Or at least nationally. I don't know if they're an international organization, but I also served on their board of trustees when I moved to Cleveland at first, just to try to help spread the good word about the value of liberal arts and promote student scholarships, things like that.
Oh, okay, that's something I didn't know. Thank you.
Sure.
So you've gone to school in Chicago, Cleveland, and Houston. Mm-hmm. Where are you from originally?
South Florida. I've moved a ton there.
South? Wow. Okay. I wasn't expecting that one. But that's interesting because you've taken to Houston so well that it really feels like you're from here. It's kind of like as if everyone here knows you. So far, I've talked to three non-major musicians at Rice from Houston who grew up in Houston who said that they've been taught by you in some capacity or other. My point being that you've everywhere in Houston as a teacher. A couple things I know is your composition department head for the American Festival for the Arts. Can you tell me a little more about that?
Sure. The American Festival for the Arts is this really outstanding program. It's been around I should know this. I think it's been about 10, 15 years. I've been teaching them for the last 4 years. It's a summer program.
Where is it located?
Right now it's in Pershing Middle School. We used to be at Episcopal High School, but we moved. It's a great facility, and it has an orchestra program, a jazz program, a choral program, and a small composition program that offers opportunities for young composers from those about to enter high school all the way up to those about to enter college in age. It offers just the most incredible opportunities for them to, over the course of the 5 weeks, write a short piece and either have it performed live by members of the faculty, most of whom are musicians with Houston Symphony, Houston Ballet Orchestra, Houston Opera, Grand Opera Orchestra, so these amazing musicians, or possibly to collaborate with a student at the Houston Ballet Academy and write a short ballet, have it choreographed, recorded by this great faculty, and then perform live on the concert. We do the concert every year at Zilker Hall.
So, sounds like a good opportunity.
It's just fantastic, yeah.
I bet it's a lot of fun to teach there.
Oh, it's a ton of fun. Yeah, I love it.
I know you currently work at Alvin Community College.
That's right.
In Alvin, Texas, where you've taught composition, music theory, music history, ear training, and my personal favorite is that I saw that you taught a class in the history of rock and roll.
Yeah. Well, that was interesting, actually. That was playing a game and, sort of keeping one class ahead of the students sort of thing because, I really didn't know much about rock before I taught the class. I was approached just a few weeks before classes were about to start, and the person who was supposed to teach it, who had taught it for many years, had taken ill, And they asked me at the last minute, can you pick up an extra class? I said, sure, what is it? I said, history of rock and roll. And I said, oh,
that's like okay. A dream.
I said, let me think about that. So, and I realized I might be walking into a situation where the students knew more about the subject than I did, but I did a ton of research and read up a lot on the subject and focused mainly on earlier rock that I felt they wouldn't know as much about to try to give them as much new information as possible, rock of the 50s and 60s and the origins of rock. And I also realized that that teaching a class on rock might be the one way that I would ever get myself to really invest in learning about rock and listening to it, and I'm glad
that's
I
unusual.
Did. Because I found some good stuff. There was some really great stuff out there.
Yeah, I know you know a lot about jazz, though, right? You studied jazz before.
I have studied jazz, yeah. I feel I have a lot more to learn, but
yeah.
I kind of feel that way about most things.
Are you
things.
Most into arranging, or do you play an instrument?
I'm a pianist, but not, you know, no great shakes as a pianist. You know, I just, I'm a fake book pianist. I wouldn't call myself a jazz pianist.
Yeah.
Sort of in that
nether
region.
Yeah, I know that one. So somehow in your non-existent spare time, you do community service work. I've heard that you volunteer at Hatch, a support group for minority teens at the Houston Community Center, I think it is, or
Counseling
Center.
Montrose
Counseling Center.
Yeah,
uh-huh. And I see that you dedicated your doctoral dissertation, which is the piece we just heard tonight, Everest, to Deb Murphy, one of the women behind Hatch. You're close, I guess?
Yeah, we're very close friends. And Deb really, I think, understood the reasons why I wanted to write the piece and understood the sort of philosophical ideals that were underpinning the creation of the work. And she was incredibly supportive through the creative process, and I sometimes played her what I had in, you know, that evil thing called MIDI, where the computer will play back something that sounds atrocious and it's supposed to be an approximation of your piece. But, you know, I'd play it back to her, and she really got what I was aiming for and was just incredibly supportive. And it's tough to write a dissertation, and it's tough to write an orchestra piece, and, you know, it... Everest is largely about the climb of the mountain. It's only at the very end that we really reach the summit.
Right.
And
can you tell me a bit more about the programmatic aspect
sure,
of Everest?
Sure, I'd be happy to.
It's about climbing Everest, I guess. What does that represent?
Well, let me backtrack just a little bit.
Sure.
I have been doing some research on what's known as the romantic sublime, which is this really fascinating concept that I think people should be talking about more.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a big philosophical movement in the Romantic period and influenced many of the artists and composers of the day. And everyone sort of argues about what it's really about, but the gist of it is that it is this heightened sensation where you feel great awe and terror at the same time. So you feel yourself split in both directions. And you feel like the greatest high and the greatest low at the same time. And it's just the pinnacle of human experience.
Mm-hmm.
And it's what they thought people should aim for through communion with nature and through, more than anything, the arts, especially music, according to some of the philosophers. And the thunderbolt was their symbol because it inspired both awe and terror. And Beethoven was one of the sort of leading figures that they pointed to as someone who really could elicit this effect.
Was this a specific group that worshipped the Romantic Sublime, or was it just a
it
general
was pretty big in Germany,
consensus?
I would say, I mean, there have been different sort of sublime movements that have gone in different parts of the world, but most of the reading I did was about the German Romantic Sublime. And it really struck a chord with me. That's a terrible pun. I'm sorry about that. But I keep a file where I keep. I'm an amateur playwright, and I keep a file where I keep ideas for plays or ideas for compositions or things. And when I had to write an orchestra piece for my dissertation, I didn't have a good idea, and I pulled out the file and I started leafing through things, and I saw my note about doing something on the Romantic Sublime. And I had a quote there that I'd found in one of these books, and it was talking about someone who had reached the pinnacle of Everest and talking about looking around and feeling basically this exact thing that the Romantics were describing, where he felt incredibly elated and filled with awe at everything around him and filled with a sense of stupendous achievement. But at the same time, there was a sense of disappointment because nothing he would ever do would measure up to this again. Mm-hmm. And there was a sense of insignificance as he looked around and realized just how small he was.
So it's the great awe and the great terror you're talking
exactly,
about.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And I thought, wow, that is just an amazing way to capture that. So I, in the course of 6 minutes, am attempting to sort of capture that in this piece, and hopefully was successful.
Was that quote Scott Lankford?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. And he contributed a chapter to the book to a book, and it was in that chapter. I think the chapter was called Everest and the Impossible. And he talked about how people who climb Everest are constantly trying to redefine what impossible really means because they have done it every way you can imagine, including on roller skates, apparently. I mean, you know, it's just they climbed one side of the mountain and they climbed the other side, which is much harder. They, you know, a blind person has climbed. And every time it's a new achievement for mankind. And there's always the question of, well, have we finally defeated Everest? Have we finally, you know, conquered the unconquerable, the impossible? Or will it always stand while we're, you know, just dust in the wind eventually, sort of?
So how did you choose to represent this idea musically?
Well, the piece starts off just trying to capture a general sense of the awe of seeing Everest. But the majority of the piece after that, it picks up very quickly. There are very quick changes. I actually spoke with someone who climbed Everest while I was writing the piece, and he told me that the changes are so abrupt. It can be so calm and peaceful, and then suddenly you are in a blizzard, and it's terrifying, and then there's rain that's going sideways, and it's just, you never know what to expect, and things change so quickly. So I tried to mirror that a bit in the piece with pretty quick changes. And there's always this build-up, this build-up, this build-up. And then finally, about a minute and a half before the piece ends, there's a section, a long section, right into the end of sustained, very high strings doing something called harmonics. And they're just in this close texture, and it's just trying to represent.
I've heard it before, and it feels like ice, actually. I thought that was pretty cool.
Great, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, it just, and, you know, I'm just trying to get that sense of being on the top and looking around in that moment, frozen in time. So, and it's both exhilarating and terrifying, and it's just, at the same time, there's an icy numbness that seems to pervade it, so.
Something I really like about your music is that you tend to gravitate towards the programmatic. There's a unifying dramatic concept behind several of your pieces. Everest, for example, is a concept piece. Your master's thesis, Peter Pan Suite, is a 30-minute ballet suite for a chamber orchestra based on the J.M. Barrie story. And you have several chamber pieces, such as Spell, which is for violin and two cellos, and it depicts a sorceress casting a spell in a forest by night. Several chamber pieces that tell stories like that, and a solo flute piece, Hibakusha, about post-traumatic stress disorder of Hiroshima and Nagasaki survivors. Just a couple of examples of the programmatic aspects in your music. It's very difficult to tell stories with music, and I think you do it very well. And I don't think it's something that a lot of contemporary composers are doing. So what is it that draws you to that? Is that just how you see music?
It might be the playwright in me. I don't know. I mean, I just, I've always been drawn to dramatic content, and I really feel like music is such an immensely powerful art form, and so is drama. And as a result, bringing the two together, it can create a really just incredible fusion of arts. So I write a lot of art songs, and I write a lot of programmatic works, and I try to write works that have meaning, you know, that in the sense that they make sense musically on their own, but if you are interested in the program, then there's something there to be told. You know, the piece Hibakusha, for instance, is telling a really important story about people who are still alive in Japan and suffering horrible effects still from Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I wrote another piece that was on child abuse, for instance. And I think that these are important stories to be told, and the arts can be a way of eliciting emotions and of calling people's attention to things in a society where sometimes we tend to want to put a damper on our emotions.
Mm. You're working on some project right now that involve collaborations with writers, right? What are they and how are they going? I mean, do you do any of your own playwriting?
I've written a number of short plays that some of which have been performed in Houston. I've got another one coming up pretty soon, a play about Hurricane Ike. It was performed in Galveston as part of a fundraiser for a storm damage theater. And we're going to perform it a few more times as a series of plays that I'm writing with Peter Wittenberg Jr., Eric James, M.J. Emig, and M.J.'s son, whose name, unfortunately, I don't know. but we're all contributing short plays about Ike, and we're going to perform them around Houston and Alvin and a few other areas that were affected by the storm. The only piece that I've written where I've written my own text is a piece called All Rights Reserved, which is a comic art song about not being able to find texts that are in the public domain that, you know, that composers can use. You know, composers can often get very frustrated. Yeah. I'm sure you've experienced this where, you know, you want to set a piece, you want to set this poem, and
you need to get the rights. Yeah.
I'm working on a song cycle right now for the fantastic bass, David Keck, and, you know, I'm struggling to get the rights for several pieces. Sometimes they'll write back and they'll say, sure, you can have the rights, just give us an advance on the royalties of $250.
Yeah.
And I want to write back and say, this is a classical piece. It will never make $250 in royalties. But sometimes it'll just be a flat out no. Like, you cannot set, no one can set the works of Robert Frost to music anymore. So that was one piece where I wrote the text because it felt appropriate to write a text about not being able to find a text.
Pretty funny.
So, yeah, it was a fun piece to write. But the only other thing is right now I'm working on a musical review with a few other people, and I am writing some of the lyrics for that. But in general, I prefer to, you know, let conductors conduct and let lyricists write lyrics and stick to what I'm good at and let them do what they're good at. Mm-hmm. I'm writing a musical right now with Joe Barnes, who is this just astonishingly good lyricist and just an incredible playwright as well. And
also works at the Baker Institute.
That's right. That's right. He's well known around Rice for he's a senior research fellow at the Baker Institute. So and he and I met through a University of Houston class on musical theater collaboration and have been working together ever since. Mm. And you know, we're excited. We've been in sort of the planning stages of this new musical, and we just work very well together. And I'm also working on an opera with Michael Remsen. Michael Remsen is a fantastic composer as well as librettist, and he is the executive director of the American Festival for the Arts. So we met through that. I often collaborate with other people.
Awesome. When you pick texts, generally my experience with your music and texts is you tend to pick good texts, which is something else I like about your music. And you use your skills at musical storytelling to convey words quite well. Actually, the first time I heard your music was I was at Mark Watley's DMA recital in the spring when he did at Shepherd, and he did your piece for baritone and string quartet,
Dulce.
I just remember looking at the program and thinking oh yeah, I love this poem. I love Wilfred Owens. This composer has good taste. So what else are you working on right now?
I've got that opera, the musical. I've got a solo sax piece that I was asked to write for Dr. Jeffrey E. Vickers, and I'm also working on that song cycle for David Keck, which has 10 poems in it so far that if we can get the rights to them, it will have 10 poems in them. And it's on the subject of the parent-child relationship. So we're exploring that a little bit further.
Do you have any upcoming performances that we should know about?
I would recommend just keeping up to date on my website, just aaronalon.com, and I always list everything that's coming up on there. Catherine Branch, who premiered the flute piece you were mentioning, Hibaksha, is going to be performing it a few times more. She just performed it on the 3rd, and she's going to perform it twice more. She's been doing this amazing series of concerts all around the world about people with disabilities, and uses my piece to talk about these people that have had these just horrific emotional effects as a result of the PTSD resulting from the being survivors of the bombings. Mm-hmm. So she's including those in this concert series that she's doing, and she's got another few performances coming up, one that's coming up in Rochester and another one that's coming up in D.C. very soon.
If someone wanted to play your music or was interested in getting a copy of a score or buying a CD, how would they go about doing that? Would they go to your website? Can they contact you?
On my website, yeah. My contact information is there. The information on the CDs that have been released are there. And any peace of mind where the score is available, it's right on the website. When you click to listen to the piece, the link is on the left with a picture of the score, so you can order the score if you'd like to have that. it's probably the easiest way, I'd say.
All right, Aaron Alon's website is www.aaronalon.com, and it's super comprehensive and user-friendly from personal experience, and you can check for upcoming concerts, like you said, and listen to some more of his past music. And literally every single piece you click on has won some kind of big award or other. So congratulations on this premiere of the stellar piece, and thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. It's been really appreciate
a pleasure.
It.